Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thanks for tuning in to Connecting Faith today. I'm Neil Stavem, along with Ted Ross. And Ted, that we were talking just the other day about kids over weekends, sometimes just getting in. My grandchildren had a couple incidents. I know your daughter had an incident. I mean, getting bumps and bruises, that's kind of just the order of the day.
Yeah, that's right. Keep that first aid kit handy because you never know what can happen.
Well, imagine if you were dealing with the children that had some special needs, and that would just kind of add to the stress, I think. I mean, you're well, in fact, we're going to talk about that. One of the big issues that our guest today have is getting some sleep. So
That would be challenging. And just logistically going places, that's a little bit more involved when you have a child with special needs.
We're going to talk about the life we never expected. Looking forward to hearing from Andrew and Rachel Wilson, their book, as they recounted just a bit about their journey, Hopeful Reflections on the Challenges of Parenting Children with Special Needs. So I want to just introduce them to you. And they start out with a quote, quoting Psalm 130. Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let your ear be attentive to my cry for mercy. Maybe you are having a struggle with your children, or maybe you're a parent of a special needs child, and this conversation, I think, will be especially important to you. Let me introduce Andrew and Rachel Wilson. They're the authors of The Life We Never Expected. And they have three children now, Zeke, Anna, and Samuel. Andrew is a teaching pastor at King's Church in London and a columnist for Christianity Today. He has theology degrees from Cambridge and London School of Theology and King's College London. And we're honored to have them with us today, talking via Skype. Andrew, Rachel, welcome and good evening to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be with you guys. Thank you so much for having us on the show.
Well, this book was just so well written, and it's a story that we need to hear because, you know, frankly, we all probably say the wrong things when we come across friends and family that are struggling with parenting their special needs children. So you do start out with a little reflection of Psalm 130. I thought, well, maybe we should start there. Just talk about this significant psalm.
Yeah, I think it struck me, funny enough, it was one of those psalms I preached on before I'd really lived through it. I think it's a remarkable psalm because it moves very quickly. It's one of the songs of ascents, and it's eight verses long, but it just moves beautifully from a real guttural cry of lament and sadness, out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord, a sort of a weeping phase. And then it turns to worship and saying, no, but with you there's forgiveness, and you may be feared, and if you mark transgressions, who can stand? It's a wonderful statement of worship and delight in God. And then it moves from there to this amazing statement, which for me is probably the most powerful little bit of the psalm. It moves from weeping through worshiping to waiting, which is where my soul waits for you, O Lord, more than watchmen wait for the morning, which is this wonderful, a watchman waits for the morning, knowing the morning is coming, but they just don't know when. And I think when you're in the middle of something difficult, whatever it is, this was our situation, but many listeners will have very different experiences, but whatever kind of difficulty you're in, that sense of waiting like watchmen wait for the morning is very powerful. You know that morning is coming, but you aren't sure when. And it's hanging on there with expectation and hope, but without clarity about when it will change. And then finally, it moves through to witnessing, I think, in our terms, where the writer concludes the psalm by saying, by praising God and then testifying to Israel and saying, you've got hope in the Lord. And I think that just that sort of weeping, worshipping, waiting, witnessing structure then informed the way we wrote the book. But just because we found that psalm such a beautiful expression, so brief and yet so rich with the sort of four things that are intertwined in the life of anybody who's going through something difficult in life. And in our case, it was the children. But in many people's cases, it could be any number of things, bereavement, or it's unexpected divorce, or singleness, or health issues. So many things it can be. And I think we found that way of processing suffering in the Bible, in the Psalms, was just a beautiful and deep way of dealing with it.
I hope as people have opportunity, they look at Psalm 130 and maybe review it in a fresh new light after our conversation today. So, Andrew and Rachel, just say a little bit about your experience, the reason that you've written The Life We Never Expected, And tell us, you know, what you're experiencing today.
Yeah, so we had our first baby in November 2008, and everything seemed absolutely fine. He was a really happy, chilled little baby, and everything seemed to be going very smoothly. So much so that we got pregnant with our second baby when he was just 9 months old. Just thought we're good at this, we should do this again. but it was when Zeke was probably 18 months old that we just began to think he's still not hitting his 12-month milestones. And we started to worry a bit and consider that possibly he was on a different developmental curve to other children around him and around us. Things kind of progressed from there, and it was our little girl was born, and everything kind of progressed. He seemed to be moving forwards, but then when she was one and he was 2.5, we had a summer where everything just came together in a perfect storm, really. And she started to have seizures and was diagnosed with epilepsy. And Zeke at 2.5 just seemed to hit a developmental wall, and his development went into reverse, and he began to lose speech, gross motor skills, social skills went, play skills. And so things progressed with both of them until Anna, 18 months later, did exactly the same thing. Mm. And this happens with a number of children who have autism, experience regression, but for ours it was quite severe. But Anna in particular, she went backwards over the course of 17 months, losing a huge amount of skills, which she has yet to regain. She's nearly 7 now. So when we wrote the book, really, we were writing at a time when it was very raw, but we were wanting something that combines almost autobiography experience, not a miracle cure experience, actually living in the pain of it, yeah, but with alongside how you cling to God and try and have your theology, a good theology of suffering shaped as you're experiencing some of this pain. So that's where we've come from. We're in a much more settled stage at the moment, and Zeke has made enormous progress even since the book came out in the UK 2 years ago. For Anna, it's been much more difficult, and she has some language, but not as much as she did at 2, probably. And has not regained all of her skills yet, and has a more kind of profound diagnosis probably of autism. And we've also had another baby. So things are quite different even from when the book came out.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing the story. And, you know, parenting a special needs child is a challenge with one, and parenting two special needs child, I imagine it's not necessarily doubled, but it's sort of exponential in the terms of the kind of care and maybe stress that it puts on.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree actually about it being exponential. And although to some extent, I think because our two older children have these needs, we've had to reshape our lives. So at the moment, we do things like Christmas and birthdays and holidays and all those things very differently from the families around us. And actually, we've found that now we've got to that point of thinking we are not the same as our friends, and so we have to do things differently. That's been really liberating. I think the hardest stage in some ways was when we were trying to live just as they did and enforce all the same discipline standards and all those sorts of things. And that was really painful and really frustrating and difficult for our marriage as well. And I think now that we've kind of moved past that, we're beginning to establish a new ordinary for family life, for us at least.
But yeah, just to sort of come to that place of accepting the new normal. I mean, that it's because it's not really normal by all societal standards, I guess.
Exactly. And I think we've now accepted things, and we are by no means through the cycle of grief or waiting or any of those things. I re-enter grief every few weeks, if not every few days, about what's happened. But our standards have changed, and I think things that we found incredibly painful that they did particularly in public before, when Zeke was really flapping and humming, and Anna would have been like licking the railings as we're at the park, and I would have used to find that excruciating, and I would have been in floods of tears, whereas now I feel like I'm not going to try and stop her licking the railings anymore. And I can usually, on a good day, I can have a bit of a giggle about it, but it doesn't kind of, it doesn't, it's not like a knife turning, whereas it probably was. But yeah, things that we never would have thought we would accept railing licking as a normal behavior, but it turns out that you can get around that and you can get used to it.
Yeah, I think you describe it in the, one of the opening chapters of the book. Some days require a lot of deep breaths.
Yes.
Indeed so. Well, we're talking with Andrew and Rachel Wilson. They're sharing, they've shared their story very openly and honestly, and it not only provides us with an understanding of what it is to raise parent special needs children, but as the subtitle of the book suggests, there's hopeful reflections on the challenges of parenting children with special needs, the life we never expected. Andrew and Rachel Wilson talking with us via Skype today from London, where Andrew is a teaching pastor at King's Church in London. And we're going to continue with more of their conversation, their story, in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. Stay tuned. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we've connected today with Andrew and Rachel Wilson. They're sharing their story as written in the book, The Life We Never Expected, Hopeful Reflections on the Challenges of Parenting Children with Special Needs. Andrew and Rachel have three children now, the two older children, both with autism, or at least on that neurobiological spectrum, Zeke and Anna. The subtitle of your book, though, is says Hopeful Reflections, and it would seem like maybe hope is in short supply most days if you'd only looked at the circumstances. Maybe just say a word about hope.
Yeah, I think it's so core to Christianity, isn't it, is the idea that the world as it is now is not the world as it will be. And I think that one of the challenges of living, I think probably, I'm 38 now, so I feel like one of the challenges of the first 34 or so years of my life before all this, I don't know, 32 maybe, before all this started happening, was you just don't, in my context anyway, I just didn't have to live clinging to eschatological hope in the sense of the hope of the end where Jesus makes all things new and there's a new creation. I just didn't really have to cling to that in very many situations because I'm a very privileged person, I suppose. I'm, you know, lovely upbringing, lovely family, nice house, lovely wife, and great job that I enjoyed. And obviously you have bumps in the road and stuff, but I just, most of the time, lived not that mindful of new creation and the desperation of hanging in there. I mean, one of the examples I use in the one of the chapters I wrote is that of the feeling like the penguins in Antarctica waiting for the light to break, where the dad penguins are standing there with the eggs. If you've ever seen those nature programs,
sure.
The male penguins are holding the eggs on their feet, and they're there for months, like in this blizzard. And it's just, they're just taking a pounding in minus 60 degree blizzards. And then the light breaks, but they know that the light will break. They just don't know when, and so they hang in there and hang in there. And it's, in a sense, it's a wonderful picture of hope. I mean, it's only really in the last 5 or 6 years that I think we have had to live that in a more desperate, clinging on with your fingernails kind of way. Because obviously a lot of people listening will probably have had that sort of story many times over and say, "Oh, come on, you know, tell us something we don't know because we've been there for decades." But in my case, I think in our case, to many extents, it was the sense of hope is something that's only really been seen in full color when we looked at the world around us and said, this can't go on. Like, this is awful. This is really, really hard. And it's at that point when you start looking forward to the new world and start looking to a future. And I think that you read the New Testament and you think these guys are all about eschatology. They are desperately looking for the return of Christ. They're looking for the world to change. But one of the challenges of affluence and free healthcare and generally high standards of living and long life expectancies, as we have in our country and yours, is that we can almost act as if the world's fine as it is. And the desperation that we find breaking through the scriptures and much of church history is sort of lost to us. So in our case, I'm not making light of it, but that's sort of the challenges we have gone through have pushed us to a place of hope that I don't think we, or certainly I would have found, had it not been for what had happened.
But as I think, Rachel, as you said here just a few minutes ago, that there's you know, times of grief, they've maybe lessened, but they still return every few weeks, or you know, and not just because you've gotten adjusted to the new normal doesn't mean that you're not dealing with the loss of dreams. Talk about kind of those down days and how you get through those.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely a work in progress, and I think at the beginning the grief was just. It was just every day, every hour, we'd see something that a child riding a scooter or bringing a painting out of nursery. And it seemed like everywhere around each corner there was an opportunity for new pain or realisation. And I think over time those experiences lessen. But we still do have, I think, things where we think, oh, gosh, wedding invites. We're not going to go through that. Or driving licences and all those things. And we've had a lot of, I think one of the joys of the last couple of years have been some of the things that have been given back to us with our son Zeke, things we were told he would never be able to do that he is already doing, which has been fantastic. But I do think particularly with Anna, it hits me really hard. And there are days when I wake up and it's just like there's a big black cloud has moved in overhead, and it can feel hopeless. And I almost have to exchange. I have this phrase where I've either got glasses of faith on for the day, or I've got glasses of fear on. And as soon as I lose my grip on God, on faith, on biblical truth, then it does seem hopeless. And it all seems like loss, to be honest, particularly with her, because she was able to do so much before. And so it's a daily battle, really, to just put my glasses of faith back on and to lean on God. And to trust him for the future in particular. And I think the future is something that I think about and struggle with probably more than Andrew. And that's often where grief really kicks in. It's not even necessarily in the now. It's more my consideration of the future. And that's where faith has to kick in too, because I've got to believe that God is going to be gracious in 20 years' time, or if the state benefit system here ends, or with care when we die even, I've got to believe that God will be gracious then. But for me, that is my biggest faith challenge, my biggest battle. And some days I win it, and some days I lose it.
Yes, because there are plenty of reasons to fear. I guess to be concerned. I mean, in the natural world. But if we didn't have faith, we would be in difficult straits, no doubt.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a lot of friends around me, friends who are Christians with kids with special needs, and friends who aren't, and. Yeah, sometimes there is not much comfort when you don't have God to lean on. I think, how do I encourage them? How do I build them up without it doing a whole kind of don't worry, be happy routine? And I depend upon, my life is staked upon on God being true and God being a deliverer and being gracious and kind to the end. But for them, it's shifting sands beneath their feet, and it's really, really tough.
You know, I'm thinking maybe for those that think most maybe have an idea of what autism is, or something along those that spectrum. What kind of behaviors do your kids do, and how does that how is it different from raising children that don't have a diagnosis like this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, like I said, our kids experienced a severe regression, which is actually quite unusual for autistic children, at least as severe or late as they did. But some of the behaviours that they have are, in terms of dealing with sensory information around them, they will often need to take part in self-stimulating activities to try and control. They feel out of control in their environment, so they do repetitive behaviours. So for our daughter Anna, for a few years, that's been teeth grinding, which was a really tough phase.
Humming,
flapping, pacing up and down. For Zeke, he ran laps over and over and over again. Before he started school, that was really, really tough. But they make kind of their own noises, which is funny because we don't really hear them anymore. And sometimes I'll be out and I'll think, oh yeah, I guess they are kind of walking in circles and making those noises. Zeke's able to control some of those behaviours a little bit more now. Whereas Anna will really struggle with her inability to process sensory information affects her walking even. So we'll be crossing at the lights, and she will literally just flop to the ground and will need a lot of support in walking simply because the noise, the lights have overwhelmed her body. So it affects them in really physical ways, and things like eating and sleeping are affected as well.
Well, and speaking of sleeping, I know that is, one of the issues that you address in the book, The Life We Never Expected, is that, I mean, you don't get enough sleep, do you?
Yeah. I think particularly when we wrote it, we were super, super tired. And ironically, we've had a newborn in the last year and have still had probably the least tiring year that we've had.
We sleep more, honestly, we've slept more in the last 12 months than any of the previous 5 years.
Well, good. But that really is just because I guess your kids got up early, right? And then of course it was constant care. They need you couldn't really leave them alone.
No, exactly. And I think you just cannot overestimate the impact of lack of sleep, can you? And it affects the way you are with each other. It affects the way you are with the children. It affects your friendships and ability to just be social, to go to weddings and to stay out late, to both be at the same prayer meeting was impossible for years because someone had to be up in the morning. And Andrew's in the past has got a fair amount of work done in the morning, albeit being distracted and watching television with the kids at the same time. But lack of sleep has at times dominated our lives, and our conversations became all about how we could possibly get them to sleep more. Mm. And thankfully, at the moment, they're in a better phase.
Yeah, they are, and it's good. It helped me see, I think, how very, very mundane some of the biggest challenges in life are. Just the things you take for granted, like eating a meal, getting dressed, having sleep, having enough sleep. Those sorts of very basic things, which are just you're so dependent on them. And then like everybody knows this, but it's when it really hits you when it happens that you are very, very dependent on things that you never notice you are.
And very weak.
And very weak and very just desperate kinds of people who it doesn't take much to destroy the equilibrium and make you realize that you're in a bit more of a mess than you thought. And I think that's what we found.
Yeah.
And at the same time, kind of going through those maybe five stages of grief and just working through them, and that there's just that extra load, sort of the rain cloud that hangs over. It's not like, the sun doesn't always shine in Britain, we know anyway, but this seemed like a little extra rain, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're trying to process grief at the same time as parent, at the same time as being really, really tired. And for us, them starting school, actually, they're at a great special needs school, has been a real gift to us, just to give us, we have our Mondays together as a couple while they're at school, and just to give us a little bit of time out. The preschool years have definitely been the hardest so far.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
We're going to talk more in a moment, hearing the story of Andrew and Rachel Wilson, as they've shared it so well in their book, The Life We Never Expected. The subtitle is Hopeful Reflections on the Challenges of Parenting Children with Special Needs. Andrew is one of the teaching pastors at King's Church London and has written a couple other books, and they have three children, Zeke, Anna, and Samuel. We're going to talk more here on Connecting Faith in just a moment. Stay tuned. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and today we've connected via Skype with Andrew and Rachel Wilson from their home in London. Andrew is teaching pastor at King's Church London, and Andrew and Rachel have written a wonderful book called The Life We Never Expected, Hopeful Reflections on the Challenges of Parenting Children with Special Needs. Both Zeke and Anna experience various levels of autism, and as you said, I think, Rachel, there's been some progress with Zeke. Anna's still a lot of things that aren't coming back, and so we want to just continue to pray for return and recovery and new things. And I'm interested to maybe, both of you just share a bit about what do you find yourself praying about maybe most frequently, and maybe how's your prayer life changed over the last 5-6 years?
Yeah, a lot of our prayers over the last few years, or at least mine, have been basically just help. And just like cry out to God. But I think more recently, I've been thinking about ways to pray, especially for Anna. And I think one of the journeys of the last few years has been realizing that we have more in common with them and they have more in common with us than perhaps we'd realized. Because really my prayer for Anna is Ephesians 3, just as it is for the people around me and for myself, that God would open up her eyes and give her an ability to grasp his love for her. And even though she and I will never fully grasp that, but that he would strengthen her in her inner being and open up her eyes really to understand his love. But yeah, so prayer has moved from a desperate help to really more about her somehow at her level of basic understanding to still know deep within her inner being the love of God.
I think Rach is better at this than me. I think I find that it's sort of intercessory prayer in the sense of, I think I find prayer in terms of worship and communion with God much, much more natural. I don't ever think I wake up one day thinking all I want to do today is pray, but I do find prayer easier when it's the sort of communion, talking to God about normal life and worshiping him and thanking him. I find that quite easy. I find the asking God for things and persevering grittily through seasons where you don't hear much and then you need to press in and ask for stuff and sort of, you know, that more importunate banging on the door of heaven kind of prayers. I've never found that very easy. And I have generally found that at the moments when I'm most almost desolate with how the children are doing is the moments I pray the most. So I found that the one aspect of my spiritual life that's definitely been enhanced when the children were at their most difficult, which is three years ago or something, was my prayer life. That's definitely gone up. I think lots of other things took a hit at that point, like we were saying just now. But prayer, I found the more difficulty I was in and the harder I was finding it with them, the more I prayed. And I think that has actually really, on one level, that's been great because it really helped. On another level, of course, you want to maintain that kind of what you've learnt in prayer in normal life. And so that's one of the things I'm doing at the moment, is just trying to reapply some of that sort of, you know, the faithfulness that almost accidentally came into my prayer life through desperately needing God to break in, and trying to apply that in more everyday sorts of contexts than I have now. So I think Rach has probably been more consistent on this, and I think is more able. That's partly because you see the challenges more with the children even now, don't you? I think.
Yeah.
I know I'm probably a more optimistic person in general, so in some ways that makes me pray less, which is bad. But it's a sort of, I think we've seen even that the ways we process it in our spiritual lives are different. So I think I've realised, yeah, when people are really up against it, we have to pray because there's nothing else for it. And that's a good thing. But I think when things are going better, as it feels like they are a bit at the moment, there's a risk as well that you become apathetic. And I know that that's a risk I face.
Well, you just talk about how you see things differently. You know, I mean, obviously, raising special needs children takes a toll on marriages. Maybe say a word or two about some things that have maybe helped you just maintain strength in your marriage.
Yeah, so I think we talk in the book about, really, in February, I think, of 2013, at that point, we really hit a wall in terms of marriage and being able to raise them together. And I think one of the reasons that had happened in the first place was because our daily lives looked so different from each other. So at that point, I was doing the vast amount of the medical appointments and the day-to-day child raising, and Andrew was doing more travel and was busy at work and was writing and stuff, and our experience of life had become so different from each other. So one of the good things that came out of that time really was Andrew just really felt really clearly this phrase, your life for your wife, basically, and about laying down your life. And he stopped all travel commitments, everything he could. He pared back his job to the more, to the less glamorous, to the absolute essentials, and became much more involved at home. And that was a very practical thing that made a big difference, because he began attending some of those appointments with me, and we came on the same page. Whereas I think up until that point, I was kind of going down very much down a line of all these strategies, and whereas he was wanting to go down a line of maintaining the same standards that we'd kept before, or that our friends around us were keeping. And so we just had a lot of conflict over how to parent until we were kind of living daily life together and hopefully met somewhere in the middle, I think.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. That's exactly what it was. And I think there's the unpleasant side of Ephesians 5. So Rachel's, you know, Ephesians 3, the depth of the love of God. That's wonderful. But the letter continues and talks to you, husbands, you've got to love your wife like Christ loved the church. And I think I love the idea of the heroism of that. I think it sounds wonderful. Yes, I will protect you. I will, and all that sort of quite almost macho side of it. But when it came to, no, the way that you're going to lay down your life to protect your wife is actually by waking up much earlier in the morning, doing no traveling ministry, which was a big part of what I was doing at the time, coming right back, saying no to almost everything, being tired all the time, doing just much more early mornings and going on the train to some hospital appointments up in London. That's how you do it. I didn't sign on for this. I wanted to be like a guard dog. I wanted to be the guy sort of policing the home and protecting and providing all that sort of thing. And I think I just realized, no, that the nature of servant leadership, and I didn't get this overnight in an epiphany. It makes me sound like a really great guy. It wasn't like that at all. Pretty begrudging at times, I think. But I came to see that this is what servant leadership looks like in this family. And I think, yeah, in spite of myself, I think got to that point. And at that level, I think that has actually been really good for our marriage as well. I think it has probably borne lasting fruit. I think that is now still true, even though things got easier. I think I would carry much more of the load around the home than I did at the time. And I think we've got a much more, our partnership in marriage is better as a result of what's happened, I think.
Yeah, I feel like we're definitely more of a team. Yeah.
You know, one of the things we haven't talked about yet is the fact that people often say the inappropriate thing in an attempt to be spiritually encouraging. Say a bit about that, and are you addressed in the book, and maybe what do you wish would have been said or not said?
There are some kind of comedy things. There's some sort of standard Christianese things that, which I think we've seen in ourselves in the past, but which anybody in suffering with anything knows that these sort of, no, don't worry, I'm sure it'll all be fine, just trust God and it'll all get better. Those sorts of things where you just think, actually, I don't know that it will get better. It may not get better. It may not get better for years. It isn't necessarily a question of how much I've prayed or how much faith I have. It may just be something really sad has happened. And you want people instead to say, I'm really sorry. If there's anything I can do, you know, those sorts of things, which anybody who's suffered bereavement or long-term sickness will know. But there's some obvious ones like that. I think when it comes to special needs in particular, I think we found there was some particular sort of cultural stereotypes, you know, people sort of say, oh, I've seen Rain Man, or, oh, you know, but of course it's a big spectrum. I'm sure they'll be okay. They'll be at this other end of the spectrum. You think, no, they're both going to need to go to this kind of a school and lead a very different kind of life. The magic cure thing, that's quite common. Oh, do you know a friend of mine who knows this woman, who knows this person, sat their autistic child on a horse and everything got better. You know, those sorts of things. And sometimes I'm sure they happen, but then they're not always the most helpful comments because those things are pretty. And in our case, actually, we did. We got a dog, and he made a significant difference to Zeke at the time. So there are little things that can help, but people quite often want to manage their sense of confusion and how on earth do we handle this by telling you that it's going to be fine. And at that point, what you really want is for somebody just to say, okay, I'm really sorry. Tell me about it. What's it like? What's good? What works? What would be helpful? And sometimes what's actually helpful is for somebody to say, you know, we'll make you a meal, or we'll encourage you, or we'll allow you to, and like my employers were fantastic, you know, just like the guys on the church team, we'll just let you not go to these things in these evenings because we know you need to be up early, or whatever it was. So in some ways, it's often very practical things. People want spiritual answers, and sometimes the solution is a very practical, everyday kind of thing. So
we personally really appreciated people saying, I'm sorry, that's so hard. But I know that that's a difficult line for people to walk because our kids were really at the very severe end, and because of the regression, it was very clear to people that they'd lost a lot of skills. So we really appreciated that. I think at the other end of the spectrum, it can almost be more challenging to comfort people, and you do have to be more sensitive, and the best thing to do is just to not assume anything by the condition, but literally to ask people, what are they like, what helps, what's the best way for me to interact with them, and also just to leave things on doorsteps with no strings attached, just meals and cakes, and not expect outpourings of grief or for that person to become the biggest confidant either.
I'm just laughing because Rachel's things will always be edible. Meals, eggs. They notice a theme. And so
yes. Which, you know, I mean, let's be frank. All of us could use a little more edible, probably. Oil. Which reminded me, I was going to talk about wondering if you get to a place where you can sort of store up reserves for the tasks ahead, almost sort of like, you know, or does the manna have to be, taken every day? I mean, is it just momentary survival, or do you feel like you can build up some core strength and resistance?
Yeah, I think for a long time for us, it was living in the survival zone. And that's living in that zone really meant making sure that everyone had eaten, showered, was alive, and not much more than that. And then I think when you move out of that time, it's almost being wise and a bit like Joseph, I guess, in years of plenty of just storing up and wherever you can, just going, okay, these are days that I can have quiet times and I can read my Bible. So I'm going to use that time wisely. And we try and invest in our marriage and also try and tackle behaviours in the kids that are difficult to tackle and cannot be tackled when you are simply surviving. But yeah, we've tended to use that phrase survival zone and then storing up.
Yeah, that's one of the things I learned that from Rachel. I just found that really helpful. She does a little diagram of it in the book, which I just almost like concentric circles of desperation. And that's certainly been our story.
The book is wonderfully written and both take chapters and it's got a wonderful cycle to it, as we talked about right at the beginning, weeping, worshiping, waiting, witnessing and breathe. We're talking the life we never expected, hopeful reflections on the challenges of parenting children with special needs. And maybe just before we go, Andrew, a word about lament. Lament's kind of a lost art, and it is important to be honest before God, isn't it?
Oh, I just think I say in the book something like, before I was 30, I didn't know why so many of the Psalms were about lament, and now that I'm on this side of 30, I don't know why so many of the Psalms are about anything else. It just seems to be, it's so, in Israel's worship and liturgy life, was just so powerful. You need to pray these prayers. You need to say sad things, even sometimes when you're not even feeling sad yourself. It's important that we do that corporately. And this will vary according to the kind of Christian circles you're in. I'm sure if you're an Eastern Orthodox Syrian at the moment, then lament is very much a part of your weekly routine and liturgy and so on, because you're in so much danger. But in the West and in a kind of our sort of evangelical charismatic sort of context, it's not the natural mode that we operate in. We're quite positive, can-do, pragmatic, encouraging. And I think sometimes just being able to say, this is really heartbreaking and we just need to, process that before God and sometimes cry and sometimes just say, this is really sad. And we've had there's songs which have been written, you know, Matt Redman's written a number of songs which have really helped us beautifully expressing some of that sadness, as well as the older hymns and It Is Well With My Soul, those sorts of things. But I do think it doesn't, for many of us, it doesn't come naturally. And just creating a church environment, we've had friends of ours in the church who've helped create an environment where there's permission to do that, to say, this is just really hard and we don't know what the outcome is and it's just kind of sad. And of course, what we found is that when you do that, you get dozens and dozens of people, often older people, often sicker people, often people who've lived a hard life, who will say, that's exactly how I feel. And the church hasn't really said that, and I'm really glad you're saying it. So I think we've just found you've stumbled into something which, of course, affects far more people than as a regular 30-something person who is doing okay in life, I would even have realized. So it is vital that we recover that and preserve the ability to say, sometimes life is really sad. It's an Easter Sunday faith, but it's a Good Friday one as well. I mean, we need both, and we need to continue professing and emotionally handling both.
Well, we're learning what it means to weep, to worship, to wait, and to hope in the Lord. And as they say in the back of the book, offering encouragement rooted in God's word, the book will help you cling to Jesus and fight for joy when faced with a life you never expected. We're talking about the life we never expected. Hopeful reflections on the challenges of parenting children with special needs. Andrew and Rachel Wilson, authors of the book. Thank you both for being so honest and transparent in the book and in our conversation today. It was an honor to talk with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having us. We so appreciate it.
Yeah, we really do. Yeah, thank you.
Andrew and Rachel Wilson talking with us today here on Connecting Faith. And coming up in just a moment, another conversation with Rick Mattson. He's the author of Faith is Like Skydiving. And we'll talk about sharing our faith just ahead on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We always appreciate the opportunity to connect with friends who help us grow and understand our faith and apply it better. And certainly when it comes to sharing that faith, we all recognize we need a little help and encouragement and to be ready to give an answer for the hope that we have. It doesn't just happen without preparation and intention. So over the past few weeks, we've been taking time to visit with Rick Mattson, who's an apologetics specialist at the University Christian Fellowship. He's served on staff there for about 3 decades, and he's author of Faith is Like Skydiving and Other Memorable Images for Dialogue with Seekers and Skeptics, and he frequently speaks on college and university campuses across the country. And so we get together and we talk about a variety of aspects of how we can more effectively share our faith. And Rick, last time we were talking, we just went through some kind of basic ways in which we can pray for non-Christian friends, because that really is maybe as much as anything a key step. I mean, you think, well, it's you know, it's not about memorizing 4 spiritual laws or a bunch of scriptures. That's important. But prayer really is a foundation.
It really is. And I'm all for being prepared, but sometimes we have to go off script. Whether we're on script or off script, prayer is the power behind this as the Holy Spirit works. And Neil, I was just thinking about that story in Acts where Lydia comes to faith in Christ. It's Acts 16:14. It says, one of those listening was a woman from the city of Thyatira named Lydia, a dealer in purple cloth. She's a businesswoman. She was a worshiper of God, and it says, the text, the Lord opened her heart to respond to Paul's message. So I'm sure Paul was prepared. He had messages that he gave, but it wasn't the power of Paul so much that opened Lydia's heart. It was the power of God opening her heart to what Paul was saying. And I think that's the prayer that we're sending out in advance, you might say. Yeah. That, Lord, when the Word of God comes to people, would you be the one who is opening their heart to receive it? Give them what the Scripture calls ears to hear, and give them eyes to see what you're doing and to respond positively to it.
And I'm sure those prayers can be done, you know, probably in secret and in private a long time ahead of time, but probably those quick little Lord help me kind of prayers in the middle of a conversation probably useful too, aren't they?
Yeah, totally. I have this image of myself and other people who are sharing the faith, and it goes like this. Sorry, we're on radio. It doesn't work that well. Okay, I have my head tilted to the right. Yeah. And I'm listening to this person with my right ear, okay? Nice. And my left ear is pointed more toward heaven. Mm. Of course, this would look odd in a restaurant. I wouldn't actually be doing it. I'd be thinking this, maybe not doing it physically. But I'm carrying on 2 conversations at the same time here. I'm listening to what the Spirit is saying to me as I'm having a conversation with this person. So my friend Larry, who's a highly educated PhD person, we're sitting in Arby's one day, and we get on to spiritual things and philosophical things, as I'm wont of doing. It was really a great conversation. And he has the gift of listening. I'm so impressed with him as a listener. He's not a follower of Jesus, but he just takes account of everything I say. And I thought to myself, this is a gift that the Lord has given him, and I think it's an indication that, A, I need to say something worthwhile that's listening, but that he's going to listen to the gospel as well. So as we talked together that day in the Arby's restaurant right here in Roseville, I was listening to the Lord. What are you prompting me to say right now? Should we be talking philosophy, theology? Should I be quoting some Bible verses or just listening to him, or how does that go? And so we had an hour and a half conversation, and I can tell you all of those things happened. There was some philosophy because we both enjoy that. There was some theological musings about the nature of God. I talked about some scripture that I've been reading and some personal testimony and story from my own life. But the whole time I'm praying to God, Lord, give me what he needs to hear right now. I want to be in step with what you're doing in this conversation. I'm not the leader of this conversation. Yeah. So it was so fun. I was so excited. I'm getting excited right now, actually.
Well, as you talked about, you know, the illustration of, you know, God opened up Lydia's heart. I mean, that doesn't always happen in the first conversation or even after an hour and a half conversation. No. So we need to have some persistence in prayer too, don't we?
Yeah. And I think if we're praying for a person and we're caring about them, and we're communicating to the gospel, it can take minutes, hours. It can take any amount of time. We don't always know. Could be weeks or months or years, and we just need to be patient and walk with that person at the pace that the Spirit is moving in their life. And that gets back to this image of us being detectives. We're the investigators here. We're trying to discern what is God doing in their life and at what pace is he doing it. And so praying into that, asking him what he's doing, and then being sensitive to that when we get into these conversations, watching for what the Lord is doing, and then stepping through those open doors that he provides.
I just think as you use that phrase about being the detective, it's, you know, there's never a cold case, right?
No.
I mean, all the cases are active, right?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's true. No one's too far gone. I mean, maybe it's been, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, but yeah. God's still at work.
Yeah, one of my friends is a pretty hostile, hardcore atheist, but I still pray. Mm-hmm. We still get together. We still talk. I haven't given up on him yet. Yeah. And you know what? He hasn't given up on me either. Mm. And that's, I think, a small sign that the Lord wants me to continue in this relationship.
Say more about that detective work. I mean, there's listening, but detectives do other things too, I guess. Flesh that out a little bit for us.
Yeah. Well, I think if I happen to be a golfer. So yeah. If I'm on the golf course and a person who's not a Christian starts sharing about their life a little bit, because I'm inquisitive, I ask questions. And they start sharing about things that are more personal to them than they normally would. Just, folks on the golf course, you're talking about golf or recreation or, you know, lighter topics. But if that person starts going deeper into their life, it happens to be a business person or a student or whatever, and is sharing more personally, and if I'm sensitive to what God is doing in this situation, if I've asked him to use me, then I'm starting to think to myself, wow, this is going somewhere. This is God working. This is opening up conversation and dialogue at a level, at a depth that I wasn't necessarily expecting. We were just talking about putting. Now we're talking about their personal life and broken relationships and business problems and so forth. Okay, I'm going to listen. And then at some point, I'm going to look for an opening that I might be able to suggest to this person that they can count on me to be praying for them, upholding them. Is there anything I can do to actually help serve them in some way? Had they thought of just asking God for some guidance and some help? Whatever it is, you putt and then you walk over to the next tee and you drive, you walk down the fairway and you're into these conversations. It's amazing if you're open to them, I think. But if the other person is disclosing themselves at this level, I take that to be a pretty strong sign that God is working in this relationship. That's my detective work. And then I can enter into what he is already doing. And that's the key. I know we talked about this before, but God is prior. I am second. He does his work. I respond. He opens the doors. I walk through. He works in their lives. I participate with him in what he is already doing. That takes the pressure off me to manufacture these things. Yeah. I'm not that good.
Yeah. And we're talking about prayer, about being a good detective, and just being sensitive. Be listeners. Be good listeners today. And we've listened to Rick Mattson again today, apologetic specialist for University Christian Fellowship, author of the book Faith is Like Skydiving and Other Memorable Images for Dialogue with Seekers and Skeptics. I encourage you to check out the book for some great, maybe new ways that you can engage in dialogue with some friends and neighbors and coworkers that you are caring about, want to share faith, and let's just be encouraging each other to pray as well. You can connect with Rick at his website, rickmatsonoutreach.com. Tomorrow on Connecting Faith, we'll talk This Is Our Time with Trevin Wax. Join us for Connecting Faith tomorrow here on the Faith Radio Network. By the way, if you missed any of today's program, want to hear it again or pass it on to a friend, we post the interviews on our show page. And check it out anytime online, the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, You can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.